Hello, my lovelies, and welcome back to another episode of Confessions of a PYP Teacher. This is Lou Gerlach with Confession number 131, where we're focusing on the exploration of culturally responsive teaching and the brain by Zaretta Hammond. As I'm writing down my ideas, to be honest, I'm full of mixed emotions as this is my last day in Lima, and I fly out early in the morning tomorrow, and I don't know how I feel about it. And ever since I was 18 years old, I've heard about this magical place from my sister-in-law. She would tell me stories about her childhood and the places she would go and the boy she used to be in love with. And all these stories were mixed with her wonderful cooking. And I quickly became entrenched into Peruvian culture. And so when the opportunity came to lead a workshop here in Lima, I was so excited to live my lifelong dream to visit this magical country. And what surprised me is that I felt like I was kind of returning home instead of visiting for the first time. And I think this speaks to how culture and being open-minded to culture really does impact who we are and our experiences, and also being open-minded as a traveler, right, as a foreigner, and also the open-mindedness of the citizens here, how they embrace foreigners. And really, I've had no issues, just but good things. And I bring this up because we've just discussed how culture frames everything in the way that we think, believe, and what we do in our lives. And now we're going to transition towards how cultures program our brain. My gosh. So I'm not going to lie, the next part of this book makes me feel a little like a numpty, as the British would say. Zaretta Hammond begins the chapter by stating, if we want to use culturally responsive teaching to support the cognitive development of dependent learners, we have to know how the brain uses culture to make sense of the world. When we know this, we can easily piggyback on the brain's natural systems to activate its unique ability to grow itself. I don't know about you, but this sounds really beyond my pay grade, but I'm going to do my best, my friends. And if I do a disservice to Zaretta's work, I hope she and you will forgive me. So what are the different parts of the brain? One thing that helped me to understand this process is what Hammond describes is the physical structure of the brain. So the actual physical components is the hardware, and culture is the software that filters through. So now she's talking terms that I can understand that are relatable. And so to help us understand this hardware, Hammond unpacks the three layers of the brain, and the first layer is the oldest to humans and their existence. How long, hundreds of millions of years, how long they've had these parts. And then the top layer is the youngest. So what we're going to be doing is we're going to be unpacking all of these three layers of the brain and getting into these layers and what we think about neuroscience. So the first brain layer is our reptilian region, or the lizard brain, because it's made up of the two parts of a reptile's brain. I was like, what? So the brain stem and the cerebellum. And apparently this is part of your brain that does not think, but only reacts, which makes sense. Because if you think about reptiles, they're constantly just gut reacting of trying not to get killed, really just trying to stay alive. And it regulates our breathing, our heartbeat, our body temperature, our digestion, blood pressure, and balance. So don't ask why, but the picture in my mind that comes into my brain is Taylor Swift and her bodyguards. You know, she's been in the news a lot in America lately, and I don't particularly know their faces, but I just see a swarm of faceless men always crowding around her at any given moment. And they're constantly following her around to ensure that no harm happens to her when she's singing on stage or hanging out with her football boyfriend, right? And so For all the Swifties out there, you're welcome for plugging your queen. For those who cannot connect or don't know who she is, watch a YouTube video, okay? All right. So, in all seriousness, though, if we're using a computer hardware metaphor, this sounds like a cooling system to me, right? So, in regards to this reptilian region, it's cooling down to make sure that the whole system is physically and emotionally doesn't overheat. So the second layer of the brain is the limbic region. Apparently, this is the region only found in mammals. So yay, we made it, my friends. We made it. And I think this must be my favorite part of the brain because it combines our emotions, our behavior, and cognition, right, to create memories and experiences. And this helps us to be more prepared for future encounters that are similar in nature. And in the limbic region, there are three actual parts to that region that Hammond refers to as the watcher, the guard dog, and Wikipedia pages. I was like, say what? So let me unpack them for you. So the watcher, which is, excuse my pronunciation, the reticular activating system, the RAS for short. It scans for possible threats and rewards and sends the information to the amygdala. Okay. So it's constantly scanning your brain. Anyone gonna harm me? Anyone gonna help me? Okay. And then the guard dog, which is your amygdala, it takes that information and it's preparing. Am I going to fight? Am I going to flight? Am I going to freeze? Or am I going to appease anything that's a threat physically or emotionally? I'm like, hey, wow. I just remember as a kid hearing fight or flight, but I didn't think about freeze and appease. And that makes sense, right? Especially when you're confronted with something that is really aggressive. And then the third part is the Wikipedia pages, which is our hippocampus. And this is where our past and current experiences are stored through the use of our working memory. If it's not useful, the hippocampus gets rid of it. Okay. And so if you think about it, we have this part of our limbic system that's watching, then coding it and saying threat to our amygdala. Our amygdala is like deciding, okay, what are we going to do with this? And then after it's passed, then your hippocampus is saying, was this important? Was this silly? If it's silly, then it gets rid of it. Okay. And when you put all of these parts together, it reminds me of an operating system of a computer that continually checks for viruses and any other threats to the system and protects itself. Now we come to the third layer, which is the neocortex region. This is where our executive functioning skills lie, such as planning, conceptual thinking, organization, and self-management. Per Hammond, this is actually where our imagination lives, not in the limbic system. But I like that. It's where your imagination lives. Isn't that just beautiful? And I think of every creative person that has shared their interpretation of the world through their choice of medium, whether it's visual arts, performance arts, coding, writing reports, sewing, furniture upcycling, and so much more. Right? I'm a Canva queen. I love creating every day something new on Canva. So my neocortex is on overload. And when I connect to the hardware metaphor, it reminds me of Windows Explorer in a Microsoft Office, where it's that little file folder you click on so that you can get access to all your files and everything's filed away into neat folders so that information retrieval is easy. And I'm always using it to find files and continue expanding on my ideas. And so that's what I think of when I think of the neocortex. So why does this all matter? Because when you think about our brains, we have to go to the neuron level. And I'm not going to lie, this is the part where I was like, ah, okay. So we have to look at all the layers of our brain work and how it impacts learning within a classroom. And I know I'm not doing Hammond's work justice, but she speaks to learning and the impact of complex information processing. Hammond states, when the brain is learning something new, it clusters neurons together to create a neural pathway. Similar to the pathway in the forest, neural pathways are important because when we go back and forth along this pathway, when thinking or problem solving, it helps us drive new learning deeper into long-term memory until it becomes automatic or deeply understood. Basically, the neural pathways are important because it creates a track in our brain to tell us that this information is important and these are the ways to use it. And we need these neural pathways to be revisited or the information will be erased. And Hammond continues, she says, when we don't practice or use new dendrites, these are our neural pathways, shortly after a learning episode. So after we learn something new, our brain prunes them by starving them out and then reabsorbing them. It assumes you didn't revisit the activity that grew the dendrites and that information wasn't important to keep. So how I'm applying that is like I'm on a plane about once every week and a half to 2 weeks. And when I'm thinking about this neural pathway, I'm thinking about things like a seat number, right? I have to remember it for that temporary instance. But when, if I don't use it again, because I'm using a different seat number every flight, it's wiping it clean. But when we're thinking about it from the lens of teaching, this is so important. Because, you know, things that this reminds me of is I learned in the past that children need exposure within 24 to 48 hours to an idea or it's lost forever. 24 to 48 hours. So if we don't revisit ideas in 24 to 48 hours, that's a problem. I've also heard that we need to revisit these ideas 4 to 5 times before it permanently stays in our working memory, because we need multiple vehicles of practice so that it stays there. And that makes sense based on what Hammond has proposed based on neural activity. And what's really interesting here, my friends, is this. We often rush this process. We'll present something 1 or 2 times and then expect children to understand it. And then we kind of get a little grumpy at children who don't get it. It's because we haven't set the neural pathway for them to be successful. So that's on us. So how is the brain connected to culture? This is something that I was like, where is she going with this? So if our brain functionality is all about keeping us safe, teachers need to be mindful of their actions and how it may trigger amygdala hijack. And this one right here, man, it has stuck with me. Hammond defines this process as, so amygdala hijack, when the amygdala is in an active state of stress, fear, or anxiety, it signals the body to release the stress hormone cortisol. The cortisol blocks rational thinking and temporarily reduces the capacity of the working memory, making learning difficult. This reminds me of former students who were magicians on projects and their written work and small group work. But when they took a test, they would freeze up, right? The stress of failure from expectations beyond me, because I never stress these, but right? Performing for family, performing for grades, performing to get in university, right? Or whatever it might be, themselves. That failure had such a hold that they couldn't unpack each question and needed guidance to get through it. It was almost like an emotional crippling. And this usually happens when teachers have not taken the time to build a healthy relationship with their learners. The learner is constantly in distress about their performance that their mind literally shuts down. So we used to hear that, you know, this was all resulting from negative self-talk. But Hammond proposes some ideas on how to be more culturally responsive, that it's not just within our brain, it's about also relationships and the conditions we create in our classrooms. So let's take a look. So the first one she talks about is be mindful of microaggressions. So, what's a microaggression? They are subtle, everyday verbal and nonverbal slights, snubs, or insults, which communicate hospitable, derogatory, or negative messages to people of color based solely on their marginalized group membership. What the heck does that mean? What this reminds me of the many films I've seen in my day of someone of color walking into a shop or a restaurant and they're not being served while other people from other cultural backgrounds are instantly being served, or social economic status, where and that happens all the time, where we see that, and that's called a microaggression, where we might choose the children all the time to the ones that are obedient, the ones that answer every question. We might choose on them all the time while snubbing the ones that are more quiet because they're still trying to formulate their ideas because they're acquiring maybe one, two, or three different languages at that time. So, thinking about those microaggressions. Number two, cultural connections. Hammond talks about that learning is more effective when we use common cultural learning aids, such as stories, music, and repetition, that we're utilizing these cultural connections to build bridges of understanding and mutual similarities and differences. And this makes sense because these are the things that we remember when engaging with our friends and family. So why wouldn't we then put them into our schooling? She also says that one thing we can do is prior knowledge connections. According to Hammond, what we already know is organized according to our cultural experiences, values, and concepts. Experiences, values, and concepts. And I don't know about you, but I'm like, if that's how my prior knowledge is organized, I'm wondering if that's going to be kind of like a checklist for when I unit and lesson plan next year, when I go back into a school. And I'm thinking about experiences, values, and concepts. How am I going to embed that? So curious. And isn't that beautiful, though? I want this to be, like I said, my success criteria when I'm teaching something new. And the last one she talks about, I'll kind of paraphrase because ideas get long, challenge thinking. Our brain growth moves forward when we're learning something new. This thing that we're learning has to be complex, open-ended, and a puzzle. We all yearn to solve these puzzles because they stretch us beyond where we are to become independent thinkers. And we all deserve the opportunity to be put into open-ended learning situations where we're stretching and growing, not just the ones that already come with the skills, right? We have to teach those skills. And so that's something to be mindful of. Are you giving more challenging, open-ended tasks to children who already have the linguistical abilities, and yet teaching less rigorous, less language, and less creative and critical thinking skills to those that have less language skills in your language of instruction? Something to think about. So I don't know about you, but my thinking has been challenged. This is the second time I've reviewed these ideas, and it's finally making sense. And I strongly urge you to get a copy of this book so you can make your own meaning of this section. It's the foundation of everything else, so it's really important that you connect and resonate on your own terms. So, hello, friends. So, I'll see you next time as we delve further into this gorgeous book. I'm telling you, this book, magic, pure magic. So, I'll see you next time, friends.